Case number 19-1798, Mary E. Chambers, Appellant v. District of Columbia. Mr. Wolfman for the Appellant Chambers, Ms. Baldwin, Amicus Curiae United States, Ms. Van Zyl for the Appellee District of Columbia, Mr. Schaaf, Appointed Amicus Curiae.
Good morning, Counsel. Mr. Wolfman, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. A discriminatory lateral transfer or a refusal to transfer violates Title VII. Any differential treatment in a term, condition, or privilege of employment is prohibited. And importantly, a term, condition, or privilege of employment is a workplace requirement, benefit that an employer imposes on, grants to, or withholds from an employee. The when, the where, the what of one's job is a term or condition of that job. As the United States has put it, the job itself must be a term or condition of employment, so that after Mary Chambers was denied her transfer, she could not have shown up the next day and performed the job as she desired, precisely because contrary terms and conditions have been set by her employer. That's what the statute says. The court should enforce what the statute says and means and reverse. Now, the labor law origins of Section 703A1 simply underscore this conclusion, because the NLRA's use of terms and conditions of employment have been understood as capacious, including all attributes of the employer-employee relationship.
Mr. Wolfman, can I just ask a background question? I know it was mentioned in the briefing that Ms. Chambers has now been transferred to a lower stress position. I just wanted to clarify or confirm that, or understand, does she still want this transfer if she could get it, or what is the nature of her interest in continuing interest in this transfer claim?
I believe, and I'm not certain, Your Honor, but I believe her interest in this claim is largely, if not entirely, retrospective. I don't know her position of whether she wants instatement into this job at this point.
So she doesn't want the transfer? She no longer, as far as you understand at this point, she no longer wants the transfer at issue in this case?
I don't know the answer to that question. I know that she seeks retrospective remedies, but I don't know whether she is seeking instatement at this time.
What retrospective remedy is she seeking then?
It would be the non-pecuniary remedies that are permitted by the
such as in
1991
this case.
Act.
So it'd be no injunction. So what would it be?
It would be the non-pecuniary remedies permitted by the 1991 Act.
Can you be more specific?
Humiliation.
So it's damages.
Yes, damages, all entirely damages.
Okay.
But I do not know the answer to your question at this point, because I do not.
Are you thinking specifically of changes to her personnel record?
Yes, I mean, there certainly could change her personnel record to indicate that she was entitled to this transfer and was denied it on the basis of discrimination. That is yet to be proved on remand, and we intend to try to prove that on remand.
Mr. Wolfman, if we rule as you were asking us to, wouldn't we be putting ourselves in conflict with most, if not all, of the other circuits?
You would be putting yourself in conflict with some of the circuits. I think not with respect to two circuits. So, for instance, the recent decision of the Sixth Circuit in the Three case is about the when of employment. And I think the necessary consequence of that decision is that the what of employment, what your job is also a term or condition of privilege of employment. I think, too, the Ninth Circuit's view on this topic is what it calls the so-called EEOC position. And the EEOC position has been for many years that job assignments are terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. But I do believe that, for instance, it would put this circuit in conflict with the Fifth and the Third Circuit, most notably.
And what's the exact standard that you are urging us to accept?
So if I might, some of this is what I've already said, Your Honor, but let me repeat it. A term, condition, or privilege of employment is a workplace requirement or benefit that an employer imposes on, grants to, or withholds from an employee, so that at the very least, the when, where, and what of one's job is a term or condition of that job. Let me add one other thing that I did not say, Judge Pillard, which is at the very least, this court should also go ahead and eliminate the distinction this court has drawn since Brown between objective and subjective interests of the employee, because those are not trained on by 703A1. 703A1 asks three questions, and they are all concerning the employer's conduct. It asks whether the employer has discriminated, whether it has done so with respect to the five protected characteristics, and whether it has done so with respect to a term, condition, or privilege.
So can I ask you
what the court should do? Go ahead.
Yep. So it asks whether the employer has discriminated against, not just whether the employer has discriminated. And I'm not sure there's a difference, but I just want to hear your take on the word against, because the statute speaks in terms of discriminating against. And what work is the word against doing under your conception of the case?
Under our conception of the case, the word against is ensures that the plaintiff has suffered an injury. And in our view, that's an injury in the Article III sense, so that the discrimination against an individual is by definition a harm.
So do you think that there is there such a thing as discriminating in favor?
Yes, I believe there could be. Often discrimination is favoring one person and disfavoring another. So the answer to that would be yes.
So if you had a case in which, say, like Johnson versus Transportation Agency, a case that involves a policy that favors some people who by a category that's singled out under Title VII, if a person who's viewed to be favored brings a claim saying that this can be viewed as favoring me, but I don't want it, would that person have been discriminated against so as to bring an actionable claim under Title VII?
I think the answer is possibly less, but let me answer it this way to begin with, which is that that is going to the question of what discrimination means, not the question of what a term, condition, or privilege means, which I think that's the principal question before this court today. There are problems on the margins in deciding what is discrimination, and that is a marginal case. The court-appointed amicus, for instance, brought up the very narrow area of affirmative action, where there are difficult considerations, as you say, between who is being discriminated against and who is being favored. But to go back to your question, I think, yes, I think a person could say they are stigmatized by the very fact that the employment discrimination has been made with respect to them on the basis of one of the prohibited characteristics. That's a close question. Let me just add, that's a close question. Mm-hmm. And it is very far from the meat and potatoes of this adverse employment action doctrine that is built up in the wake of Brown.
Mm-hmm. So your view is that whenever there's a lateral transfer from one position to another, that a person who either is denied a transfer that they would like or is forced to accept a transfer they would dislike has stated an actionable claim, because by definition, the denial of a lateral transfer or the forced acceptance of a lateral transfer is discrimination against.
Yes. And then let me just add, not only yes, but the question of the transfer goes to what a person does, what their job is at their employer. It's within the heartland of terms, conditions, and privileges. I want to point out that our position is consistent with the EEOC's views, longstanding EEOC views, both in its policymaking and adjudicatory capacities. The agency has given terms, conditions, and privileges a quite wide berth, consistent with the ordinary meaning of those terms.
Mr. Wolfman, I want to follow up the Chief Judge's question. Keep his question in mind and tell us how your view of the standard would apply to the store clerk hypothetical in the court-appointed amicus's brief. A supervisor tells a salesperson to work the sporting goods section for an afternoon instead of the power tool section?
I think that would be a term, condition, or privilege of employment. And the question would be whether that transfer, modest as it may be, was motivated by discrimination. I don't think job assignments, you know, this is dovetails very well with the EEOC guidance I was just talking about. Job assignments are terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. I appreciate that that is not within the heartland of Title VII. You know, modest assignments in the course of a day are not going to lead to lawsuits, generally speaking. But if you ask me to answer that question in the abstract, that is term, condition, or privilege of employment. And the question, and with all respect, this was the point I think you were making at the end of your dissent in the Douglas case, Judge Tatel, is that we shouldn't conflate terms, condition, and privileges with discrimination. And the question in that case is, was it discriminatory? Something that modest is unlikely to be motivated by discriminatory intent.
Mr. Wolfman, just to follow up on that questioning, what if the employee requested, everyone was in offices? Your reply brief talks about if women were assigned to cubicles, but men were assigned to private offices. But what if the situation were that a female employee requested the corner office when it became available, but it was not given to her, it was given to a male employee? Is that a term, condition, or privilege of employment?
I think, yes, Your Honor, yes, Judge Wilkins, I mean, that's the kind of perks that are frequently, to use the term of the statute, privileges of employment. And we know from common experience that those things are valued in the workplace. They relate to prestige, and they are clearly terms, conditions, and I would say principally in your hypothetical, a privilege of employment. And the point being that cannot be made, that decision cannot be made on the basis of one of the prohibited, one of the prohibited characteristics.
Is the job lateral transfer, is the job definition doing any work? In other words, if an employer defines the job to include employer prerogative to shift people around in certain ways, you know, trade offices, shift around tasks, you're gonna be front of the house, and if we need you, back at the house, and if we need you, bussing tables, and that's gonna be your job, does that have any impact at all on how we do the analysis? Or is someone going to be able to say, well, it's a de facto lateral transfer that I was moved from the front of the house to the back of the house, and in fact, I see a pattern of the minority employees being moved?
Right. So the answer to your question is no. I want to explain why and give an example. The answer is no, because if that is motivated by discrimination, it is actionable under Title VII. And the reason is that you are describing, Judge Pillard, the ordinary incidents of at-will employment. And the court-appointed amicus makes a point of this. Of course, jobs often allow for the moving around of employees during the day or during a week or as part of that person's job description. And Title VII doesn't seek to alter those kind of at-will employment prerogatives, except if the decision is made on the basis of an improper motive with respect to those five characteristics. Let me give an example. I think it helps make the point, because you mentioned front of house, back of house. Let's take the example from EEOC versus Abercrombie and Fitch. That's the headscarf case, religious discrimination matter. Let's assume for a second they accommodate the employee and she's permitted to wear a headscarf. And she is a front of the house greeter at Abercrombie and Fitch, but the employer believes that the customer preference is inconsistent with that, and they move her to the dressing room so she's not seen as frequently by the customers who the employer perceives would be offended. And that is plain discrimination. It's highly stigmatic, and it could undermine the ability of this individual to progress in her career. And I think that's your question. The answer is that's impermissible.
Can I ask a question? Go ahead.
When you mentioned that it is stigmatic in the answer to that last question, are you suggesting that actions have to be stigmatic to be actionable or for there to be an Article III injury? I mean, why? What is the role of stigma in this analysis?
Oh, I think the employer's subjective feelings, as I said, are irrelevant. So you don't need stigma. My point made here and principally earlier was that stigma is enough to meet Article III's injury requirement. And in the heartland of cases that we're talking about, what job you're doing, whether as in the cases referring to earlier, the Douglas case, whether someone is recommended for a lucrative job award, all of those things are well beyond stigma. My only point about reference to stigma is that in the Abercrombie and Fitch hypothetical, there's at least stigma and then some. And it's exactly the kind of stigmatic injury that this statute is meant to eradicate.
I'm not sure you entirely got a chance to finish your answer. You started to make a point about how we should eliminate the distinction between the objective and subjective effect on employees. And I wasn't sure where you were getting that from. And you said the statute is trained on the employer. So what about a highly subjective, particular feeling of harm or burden or grievance by an employee that's actionable? And yes, tell us how you get there.
Let me give an example that would not cut the mustard under Brown. Someone just applies for a job in the first instance, and they want the job for entirely subjective reasons. They think they would enjoy the job. Many other people in society, most people in society, would disagree that it's a good job. We know for a fact that if that person is denied the job on the basis of one of the five protected characteristics, it is impermissible under Title VII. And a lateral transfer is simply the functional equivalent within the work relationship after hiring of the hiring.
Can I just ask a follow-up on that? So suppose that the jobs are differentiated by the day of the week. So one job, it's the same job in description, but one's a Monday position and one's a Tuesday position. And the plaintiff brings a claim and doesn't articulate a particular reason that one day is preferable to the other day. And does the plaintiff, under your conception of the case, have to do that? Or is it enough to say that they wanted to have the Tuesday job instead of the Monday one, or conversely, they were forced to accept the Tuesday job instead of keeping the Monday one, whichever way you want to look at it?
Right. I think the answer to that, Your Honor, is that states a claim as to term, condition, or privilege. It would be enormously difficult to prove the discrimination if you didn't go further. And let me just say, this is not that different what is going on in the three situation, the recent case out of the Sixth Circuit. That's about shifts. And some people might prefer night shift. Some people might prefer day shift. In real life, the person is going to prefer Tuesdays because of, say, daycare responsibilities.
Right. So in the three case, for example, it was at least, I think, somewhat evident why there was a preference for one shift over the other. And all someone had to do was to say it. And I guess the question is, do you think someone has to say that at all? Or is it just this? That's just not part of the equation.
That is not a part of the equation in asking whether something is a term, condition, or privilege of employment. Mm-hmm. And
if the employer says, I have two employees, John has small children and wants to know that he can be home on Monday evenings because his partner is working, and Daniel doesn't have small children and doesn't care when he's home. So I'm going to put John on Monday and Daniel on Tuesday. And well, actually, John on Monday and Margaret on Tuesday. Can Margaret bring a sex discrimination claim saying, I've been discriminated against because I am a woman? And or I guess I'm giving a bad example because it's not linked to sex. But how about the mom is being given the Monday evening because she's a mom, and the employer says, I want to accommodate you being home, and John doesn't care.
The answer is yes, the claim is actionable as to terms, conditions, or privileges. Again, you know, some of these hypos indicate that these would be difficult to prove as a matter of whether discrimination has occurred, whether it's as to a protected characteristic. Again, I mean, I want to be careful here, but this, again, this is the point I believe that Judge Tatum was making at the end of his dissent in the Douglas case. That's the case about job awards. We shouldn't be looking at terms, conditions, and privileges in this subjective, objective way. The ultimate question is whether there's discrimination, and we should not conflate the two.
Mr. Wolfman, to go back to the Sixth Circuit case, however it's pronounced, seems there that the court actually implies pretty strongly that the transfer, the shift change in that case, would not have been actionable but for the effect on the employee's seniority.
I respectfully disagree. With respect to one of the employees who actually had his shift changed,
right,
the court is pretty clear that that person is going to have an actionable claim. And in fact, that claim has been viewed as going to the, on remand in the district court, as going to the jury solely on the question of damages. As to the other employees, and I think this is what you're getting at, Judge Ginsburg, the court remanded, mm-hmm. and some of those employees simply said that they want the ability to be in the presence of other Black employees. And so something as minor, as relatively minor as those associational interests might be honored on remand.
I'll take you back to the text. Here's the holding with regard to the lead plaintiff. When an employee's race is a basis for a shift change that denies the privileges of the employee's seniority, the employer has discriminated on the basis of race. Then going on to the other employees, the city did not alter the shifts of the other claimants. They brought claims for discrimination on the ground that the city's race-based assignment policy affected their bidding schedule, controlled when and with whom they worked, as you just said, reduced the benefits of seniority, and diminished their supervisory responsibility. So in other words, none of these was just a naked claim of a transfer or a shift change. They all invoked something, which I think fully, I mean, clearly comes within your point about terms, conditions, and privileges of employment, right?
But that is correct.
But it is not a case of the Sixth Circuit simply saying anything goes. It doesn't matter if all you've got is a naked shift change.
That is correct. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is that number one, the court was sitting as a panel. It had precedent similar to the precedent in Brown, and the circumstances of the particular plaintiffs there were such that no further argument had to be made. In other words, the plaintiffs in that case didn't need to make the argument that stigma alone was sufficient. But so I think in that respect, Your Honor, Threed is just silent on that question.
I don't see why stigma has entered into this discussion, frankly. I think you mentioned it sort of offhandedly, and it's a distraction, because the case either states or does not state a complaint without regard to stigma.
I think that's right. I was trying to respond to some of the hypotheticals that I believe are not really at the heartland. To decide this case, and this goes to the questions I was getting from Judge Pillard, I think what the court needs to do is say what a term privilege and term condition and privilege is.
No, we don't. All we have to say is that this is one.
You could do that. You could do that. I would be, and it's not my job to decide how far you should go, but I think it would be important to say that not simply that lateral transfers are actionable, but other things that in the wake of Brown have not been actionable, such as an employer's policy not to recommend someone for an award on the basis of race, a lucrative award. What about shift changes, as in Threed? So I think the court should give some guidance as to the other cases, but that is obviously not my call.
Mr. Wolfman, why do those cases need any other guidance based on your theory of this case? I mean, your theory is that the denial of a lateral transfer on the basis of race is actionable, period, right?
That is right. And
so why would we need any guidance for any of those other cases?
Well, the court...
The standard you articulate or wish us to articulate would apply to all of those cases, wouldn't it?
That is correct. So the standard, that is right. The standard I articulated to Judge Pillard is plenty capacious to cover all those cases.
Well, that may make sure.
It's not a question of capaciousness. It's the question of your simple definition of what is discrimination against, right?
That is correct. And also
you're beginning to make this more complicated than I thought it was when I came into this. So
I agree.
Am I right that
you are absolutely right?
That's your position. Your position is that the denial of a transfer on the basis of race or sex is discrimination against that person. Now, that person may or may not win on the merits, but that is an actionable action, correct?
That is correct.
I think something more is involved. I think we have to say that it's actionable because that is a term, condition, or privilege of employment.
That's right.
And yes, of course. That's exactly right.
And if we say that, then it's a strong implication that anything that is infringes a term, condition, or privilege of employment is actionable.
That's right, Your Honor. And so let me
slow me down. I'm fine with that, but that is the implication.
That is correct. So let me repeat, Your Honor, if I might, that a term, condition, or privilege is a workplace requirement or benefit that an employer imposes on, grants to, or withholds from an employee.
Can I follow up? If our decision were about transfers on the ground, they're embody or have impacts on terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. Can you tell me exactly what counts as a transfer? And in particular, going to the store hypothetical where you work, which section of the store you work within. If the job is described as you are a floor salesperson and everybody rotates through different departments constantly, so sometimes you're in sporting goods, sometimes you're in power tools, sometimes you're in home goods, sometimes you're in pharmacy. And if what the employer said is, this morning, I need you to be in sporting goods. And the employee said, and in the afternoon, you'll go over to power tools. And the employee said, no, I want to be in power tools all day. Is the decision to put her into sporting goods in the morning, you may have an argument about whether it affects terms, conditions, or employment. I just want to know, does that location decision for the morning constitute denial of a transfer?
This goes to what the word transfer means. I think exactly. That probably is a denial of a transfer, but one could think it, but even if it's not, Judge Millett, it's a job assignment.
Right.
And so
I understand your argument on that front.
Right.
So, but does a transfer, is even different locations when your job description is work anywhere, even for an hour. Can you run over and handle register 2 for me, please? We've got a long line. So leave the sporting goods. We need another cashier right now because we're really busy. That's also would fall within your definition of transfer.
That's a difficult question. So let me answer it this way.
That's why I asked. Right.
No, I understand. But the answer is, my answer would be yes. But I want to extend my answer because ultimately, I don't think the answer, with all respect, matters because there are a number of categories that have fallen under the general principle of adverse employment action in this adverse employment action doctrine. Some of them are referred to as demotions. Some of them are referred to as transfers. Some of them are referred to as job assignments. I think job assignments is more of the umbrella term, and that's the term used in the EEOC guidance, and that would be a job assignment, what you're talking about. And it's a very minor
one. Transfers are a subset. So not all job assignments are transfers. I just want to know, because if as Judge Tatel and Judge Ginsburg were talking about, and as the briefs talk about having a categorical rule that transfers always impact terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. I want to have some sense of what counts as transfers. And is it the same as job assignments or is it smaller? And if it's smaller, what's the difference?
I guess my answer is it's not smaller. It's a different way of describing the same problem, which is you can't assign someone to a job, whether it's for a week, a month, short period, a long period, on the basis of one of the five prohibited characteristics.
The situation that Judge Millett described is one in which the employer has given the frontline supervisor discretion on assignments, but cannot give that person discretion to assign on the basis of race. Right? This all comes out of experience with these terms in the NLRA, right? And sure. If I say, I want to put the union adherent over here, so he has fewer contacts with other employees, that's a prohibited reason for an assignment. Doesn't matter whether it's for a day or for a permanent job.
That's exactly right, Judge Ginsburg. And this court held in Microimage Digital, which is cited in our reply brief, that a one-day transfer without pay was a term or condition of employment within the meaning of Section 883 of the NLRA.
So just to be clear, then, there's no technical no specialized definition of transfer. What we would decide are under your rule for categorical treatment of transfers is any job assignment, no matter how temporary or brief, and no matter how the job is described, as long as there's a change in location.
That's right, because I think in the terms used by the statute, there is no distinction, because the statute refers to terms, conditions, or privileges, and all the things that you've mentioned, Judge Millett, however minor some of them may be, are still terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. And as Judge Ginsburg just said, the employer is free to do all those things in the absence of discrimination.
And Mr. Wolfman, another way to put that, would it be fair to say that your position is that yes, employers have a lot of discretion, but under no circumstances, at any level, can an employer make a decision regarding an employee based on race, correct? Yes. That's your point.
That is the point I was making.
Whatever is happening in the workforce, whether it's a transfer or whether it's a supervisor with discretion to move people around, what we know is that in the workplace, this is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, right? In the workplace, employers may not make decisions based on race.
That is correct. That is correct. That is our position.
Right. That's the broader rule. We keep getting confused whether we're talking about your broad rule, and it's not to say that something might not be actionable. I'm just trying to figure out what's actionable within the framework.
Mr. Wolfman, did I state it more broadly than you have?
That is the way that we have stated in our briefs. That is the way I stated in my opening this morning. That is our position. And the other point I was making is simply that the circumstances here are within the heartland of the provision. This is the job itself.
Mr. Wolfman, just go back a second. There may be things an employer does that do not, and does on the basis of race, that do not constitute a term, condition, or privilege of employment. They're going to be narrow and inconsequential if that frontline supervisor always has lunch with the whites and not the blacks. Probably not.
Well, the question, there are some things, this goes back to the original statement I made at the beginning of this argument. A term, condition, or privilege is something that an employer imposes on, grants to, or withholds from an employee. So your example may not be something that is imposed on, granted to, or withheld by an employee, and your example may be a situation where it's hard to ascribe that conduct to the employer. You generally do not have problems of ascribing liability to the employer when an employer has taken discrete action. And notably, all the cases in this court's adverse employment action doctrine flowing from Brown are discrete actions in which there is no concern about ascribing the conduct to the employer.
Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you at this time, Mr. Wolfman.
I have. Sure. This is Judge Katsas. You can't see me, but I'm here. Do you quarrel with the proposition that de minimis harms are not actionable under Title VII?
I do. If it depends what the question entails. I don't think that Title VII incorporates any de minimis exception. And this goes back to my discussion with the Chief Judge.
So you think Judge Sutton got it wrong in threat to even to say, while he seemed to be pushing the law in a plaintiff-friendly direction, but he did say de minimis harms are not actionable. You disagree with that?
I do. There is no de minimis exception within the terms of Title VII.
But there's a centuries-old background rule, de minimis non curat lex.
That is correct, but here's an important difference. This court has said, for instance, in Public Citizen versus Young, that in applying that doctrine, you have to look at the purposes of the particular statute and have to train on the words of those statutes. This Section 703A1 is capacious, and our position is that once you've proven discrimination, you've gotten over any harm that could be viewed as de minimis. So elimination of any de minimis exception is part and parcel of the words of the statute. The stigma alone, discrimination itself, is enough of a harm. It's an Article III harm, and it gets you over any de minimis hurdle that might exist.
Okay, one more question, which is, as far as I can tell, the parties have just addressed the substantive law under Section 703, but you also need a cause of action, which comes under Section 706. And in order to bring a claim under 706, the plaintiff needs to be a person aggrieved, which is a term of art that usually connotes injury and seems like a pretty plausible textual hook for at least saying not a de minimis injury. Any thoughts on that?
My answer is identical. My answer is that someone who, with respect to whom a employment decision has been made with respect to race, sex, national origin, and so forth, has been aggrieved within the meaning of the statute. And so to the extent that there is any de minimis hurdle, it has been exceeded. And that constitutes aggrievement.
I understand. Thank you, counsel.
Unless my colleagues have additional questions for you at this time, Mr. Wolfman, we'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal. Thank you. We'll hear from the United States now.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Anna Baldwin for the United States as amicus. This court's decision in Brown is fundamentally flawed and should be overturned. That is so because, as the court's been discussing with counsel for the plaintiff, Brown imposes an additional atextual injury requirement that is contrary to the text and purpose of Title VII. Brown's atextual additional injury requirement puts a whole range of blatantly discriminatory conduct beyond the reach of the statute. Under Brown, Ms. Chambers' employer could have said to her directly, "I'm not going to transfer you because you're a woman. I'm only going to allow men to transfer." And under Brown's rule, that would be okay. There would be no claim unless Ms. Chambers had further proof of objectively tangible harm. That result is clearly wrong.
I just wanted to follow up just for my own clarification. You advocate for the same sort of categorical rule as to transfers that Ms. Chambers does here. And do you agree that when we say the word transfer, that actually just means any alteration in job duties, job location, job hours, no matter how temporary?
Your Honor, deciding here. I agree that, again, you know, as to transfers, that's in the heartland. The job that you do, there's no more fundamental term, condition, or privilege than your literal job. But in terms of, you know, the categoricalness of the rule, what's a transfer, what's a job assignment, I think the important focus is on what does terms, conditions, and privileges mean.
Well, Ms. Baldwin, I'm curious why you're resisting that question. Can you give us an example of an action an employer could take based on race that would not violate the act?
No, Your Honor, and I definitely don't mean to resist the question. Yeah. I guess I can't. And I think that's what's important here is to continually separate out, you know, the discrimination element from the terms, conditions, and privileges element.
My question is not whether something's allowed under Title VII, when some form of discrimination is allowed or not under Title VII. My question is, when you ask us to hold as categorical matter that transfers fall within based on intentional discrimination or a prohibited characteristic.
Yes.
Those transfers are categorically affecting terms, conditions of employment in a way that Title VII prohibits. And that's one decision. And another one would be any change in job assignment in any way, shape, or form. And all I'm asking you is, are those the same things or different?
Your Honor, those are different. Definitely, there's a durational difference that I'd understand between a, you know, temporary job assignments and a permanent, you know, job position. There's a different level of formality. But what there isn't a difference is that both of those things are encompassed within terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. And so it's certainly within this court's discretion to decide how broadly or narrowly to write the decision. But the import—
I'm just trying to figure out if is there a definition of transfer? Because the factors that seem to be relevant, change in job duties, does not imply a time limitation. Change in the hours that you work, even if your job duties are the same, doesn't imply a time limitation. It could be changed for a day, it could be changed for a week, but if it's on the basis of race or sex, it's equally prohibited. It could be a change in your location, even if your job duties and hours remain the same. I assume, tell me if I'm wrong, if any of these things don't count as transfers in your view. And so if I've changed location, even say within a building from the east side to the west side, but my duties are the same, my supervisors are the same, the hours are the same, but that would still be a transfer.
Yeah, Your Honor, again—
Now, then that does sound like job assignments and transfers are the same thing. So I'm just trying to understand what it is. No one defined transfer for me in all the briefs. And so I'm trying to figure out what it covers, because it's hard to figure out logically why it would stop with transfers. If what we're looking at is whether terms, conditions, or employment or privileges of employment were affected.
I think the core point that Your Honor is getting at, you know, transfer is not a statutory term. The statutory term is terms, conditions, and privileges. And that is a capacious term, and that is a broad term. And it is meant to get at the whole sweep of things that an employer could do in a workplace. It's meant to strike out disparate treatment in the entire employer-employee relationship. So the limiting principle is not, if Your Honor is looking from one, it's not going to come from terms, conditions, and privileges. That means the who, what, when, and how of the employer-employee relationship. And it is going to be a broad definition. So the court could say, you know, given the breadth of that definition, it is certainly obvious that a job transfer includes that. But the outer limits are going to be policed, you know, in the more marginal cases, can you actually prove that it's discrimination? And you know, while Brown's additional injury requirement showing objectively tangible harm, we don't think that that's correct. You know, there's, of course, some sort of background principle of Article III injury in fact, that's going to have to be proven in every case.
Can I ask you what your conception is on behalf of the government of the difference between A1 and A2 in the statute? Because A2 speaks in terms of adverse effect. And disparate impact falls within A2. And the way you've described A1 in answers to questions so far gives A1 a broad reading, understandably. And does A2 do any work with respect to disparate treatment in the United States' view? Because A2 has an adverse effect component that you think requires something that A1 doesn't. So does that mean that A2 is, at the end of the day, purely relevant in disparate impact cases and it just has no independent salience in disparate treatment cases?
I think it's a plaintiff could plead a disparate treatment claim under A1 or A2. It's clear that you can't bring a disparate impact claim under A1.
But is there any disparate treatment claim under A2 that couldn't also be brought under A1?
No, there's, it's hard for me to think of one, but A2 retains, notwithstanding the breadth of our understanding of terms, conditions, and privileges, A2 retains independent meaning because that's the original disparate impact provision. You know, there are further provisions from the 1991 amendments in subsection K, but A2 is as originally passed where disparate impact lives in the statute.
So that's the only independent significance of A2 from the government's perspective is that it allows for disparate impact theory, but for disparate treatment claims, you don't even need A2 because you can bring anything under A1 that you could otherwise bring under A2.
Well, historically, I think A2 was calling out, you know, very important, you know, types of disparate treatment as well, the segregation, the classification. And so, you know, as the case law developed, I think A2 did important work at that time. But if you're asking, Your Honor, whether there those claims couldn't equally be brought as A1 claims, they could equally be brought as A1 claims.
And then can I just ask one other question about the relationship between some provisions? And I know that the federal sector provision isn't directly at issue here, but I noticed that in your brief, in a footnote, you've cautioned us to be reluctant to talk about the federal sector provision. And specifically what you say is we should avoid suggesting the Title VII's federal sector provision necessarily prohibits the same conduct. And I'm just wondering, what is it about the federal sector provision that wouldn't reach the same conduct? Because when I look at the words, it seems, if anything, at least as broad as A1, because it speaks in terms of decisions affecting employees shall be made free from any discrimination based on the same categories. And how is there a world in which the federal sector provision covers a lesser swath of conduct than A1 does?
I don't take issue, Your Honor, with the notion that, you know, any kind of discriminatory motive is, you know, equally prohibited under the provisions. But the federal sector provision doesn't have the same terms, conditions, and privileges language. It speaks in terms of prohibited personnel practices, and it has a separate statutory cross-reference that has a whole separate enumeration of what those prohibited personnel practices are. So as I sit here today, I can't come up with a concrete example of what would be a prohibited personnel practice that somehow doesn't overlap with terms, conditions, and privileges. But I think the important point is the court can address that, you know, sort of statutory textual matter as it arises. Under both cases, under both provisions, the kind of lateral transfers that we're talking about here, the job transfers would be prohibited on the basis of discrimination equally.
Do you take issue with, you referenced the objectively tangible harm language from the Brown decision. What about the materially adverse language that's used there too, which the Supreme Court might also use in 704 in defining what discriminate against means? Do you agree that there is or is not, or do you think there is not a materially adverse requirement for 703A1 and 2? If there is it just categorically met by the fact that a term, condition, or privilege of employment has been affected?
Your Honor, I think either there's not a materially adverse requirement or it's categorically met by the fact that
which one?
I think
it's a matter of statutory interpretation.
Well, as a matter of statutory interpretation, there are three elements to the 703A1 claim, that there's discrimination, which is to treat differently in a way.
No, it's discriminate against, which is the same phrase that the Supreme Court said means materially adverse. So I'm asking you whether discriminate against in 704 means the same thing in 703A1.
So respectfully, I don't understand White's discussion of materially adverse to be specifically about defining the term discriminate against. It's certainly true that both of 703 A1 and 704 use the term discriminate against. What I understand, you know, the materially adverse discussion that's happening in White to be doing is saying, look, this is a separate textual provision. It doesn't have the same restrictions as 703. It's not limited to terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. So it has no workplace limitation. And importantly, it has no limitation where there has to be a relationship to conduct on a discriminatory basis. And so we have to be able to separate out what is a meaningful harm from a trivial harm. And that's what the materially adverse requirement is doing. But in 703, when you have intentionally discriminatory conduct that regards the workplace, it's hard for me to come up with an example of a trivial example of intentional discrimination where you're having a policy that's going to discriminate, distinguish between Black and white employees. And we're going to say that that's a trivial harm. So it's because 704 doesn't have either the terms, conditions, and privileges language or the limitation to the workplace, because retaliation can happen outside of the workplace, the court had to impose an additional materially adverse requirement there. So that's how I would understand the difference and why we don't think that there's a materially adverse requirement is applicable to A3. The injury requirement.
Okay. So just to be clear then, you don't think there's a materially adverse requirement. I get that you think even if someone said there was, it would categorically be met because you're affecting terms, conditions, and privileges of employment.
Yes.
You don't textually, but just the government's position is there is no material adversity requirement for 703A1.
Textually, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you, Ms. Baldwin. Thank you
very much.
Thank you. We'll hear from the district now, Ms. Van Zyl.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Caroline Van Zyl on behalf of the District of Columbia. The district agrees that this court should overrule the objectively tangible harm test from Brown versus Brody with respect to lateral transfers. But how the court arrives at that result matters tremendously. Much of the briefing in this case is focused on two starkly contrasting options. On the one hand, maintain the status quo as is, and on the other hand, become the first court in the country to throw open the doors and say that all workplace conduct is actionable under Title VII, no matter how innocuous. But the Supreme Court has rightly cautioned against issuing a broad ruling where a narrow one will do. Here, the district believes that it would suffice to hold that the conduct at issue here, a lateral transfer, when made on the basis of a protected trait, constitutes discrimination with respect to the terms of employment. Making a modest adjustment or clarification to this court's case law, similar to the approach taken by the Sixth Circuit in the Threat case, with respect to lateral transfers would suffice to answer the question presented here. As to actions outside the scope of a lateral transfer, this court should proceed in a case-by-case common law fashion to determine what exactly constitutes a condition, term, or privilege of employment, and in what circumstances the adversity threshold is met.
What's the adversity threshold? Because you said two things. One is whether the challenged action affects a term, condition, or privilege of employment. And then you also said an adversity threshold. And I can see how term, condition, or privileged conceptually could be a limitation. But is your view that there is some adversity threshold that's independent of that?
We do believe that there are two separate requirements of the statute, Your Honor. Discriminate against means to treat differently in a way that injures or to treat worse. The Supreme Court has said that both in White and in Bostock. So that is one requirement. And then separately, you must also—
What would fall outside of that? So in a case involving differential treatment, let's just stipulate that there's differential treatment based on a prohibited characteristic. What's a case in which the differential treatment based on a prohibited characteristic nonetheless doesn't satisfy the adversity threshold because it doesn't constitute discriminate against?
So, Your Honor, we think that there are a variety of situations that may arise in the workplace that would be truly de minimis. For example, if I am assigned the cubicle with a view of the fig tree, but not of the fern, which I prefer, that seems to be relatively de minimis.
Suppose it was done on the basis of race. Suppose there was a memo in the file which said, we're not going to assign the employee to the view of the fig tree because the employees are Black.
Well, Your Honor,
what's the answer to that question?
So
take my hypothetical. There's evidence in the record that the employee who asked to be transferred to the view of the fig tree was denied it because a supervisor wrote in his file that he was African-American.
Your Honor, we do not think that that would be actionable. That would be de minimis. That said, as a normative matter, obviously, no.
Wait, so this statute was passed in 1964 when there was blatant racial discrimination in the workforce. And you think the D.C. Circuit sitting on bank should now say that the kind of blatant racial discrimination in the hypothetical I just gave you was not, in fact, what Congress had intended? Do you have any evidence at all for that?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, we believe that what Congress intended and what is sown throughout the legislative history is to eliminate differences in terms or conditions that would affect your opportunities.
It was to eliminate racial discrimination in employment. That's what Title VII was passed for.
Well, again, respectfully, Your Honor.
Isn't that correct? Am I wrong about that?
It uses the term discriminate.
Am I wrong that Title VII was passed to eliminate racial discrimination in the workforce?
No, Your Honor, but there's a question as to what discrimination means. And we would merely suggest.
And you think that Congress in 1964 intended to eliminate really bad discrimination, but not so bad discrimination. Is that the point? Discrimination that maybe a court doesn't think is serious as other kinds of discrimination. Is there what? There's certainly no evidence for that in the text of the statute. I'm a little surprised to hear that we would be ruling that exactly the kind of racially motivated workplace behavior that the act was passed to deal with, in fact, isn't covered by the act.
2 points, respectfully, Your Honor. As to the text, we believe that the term discriminate against does have a diversity threshold, that it means to discriminate against in a manner that injures. And so, for example,
well, in my case, take your fig tree against. Isn't if an employee who is African-American is denied the office with the view of the fig tree when a white employee would get it, what's not discriminatory about that? What's not discriminating? Isn't that discriminating against the African-American employee if that office with the fig tree would have gone to a white employee?
Your Honor, respectfully, there's no objective injury in that circumstance. And we don't think that Congress
really?
Would have passed it. No, no.
I remember my hypothetical includes evidence in the record, in the employee's file, that this particular employee was denied the view of the fig tree because she's an African-American.
Your Honor, that's pure subjective.
The district's position is that that's not covered by Title VII. I don't mean that she wins. She might lose her case. But the D.C. district's position is that that is not covered by Title VII, correct?
No, Your Honor, we don't believe that that is covered by the text of Title VII, much in the same way that discrimination by religious employers in certain contexts or small employers isn't covered by the text of the statute.
Well, would the same be true in a workplace where the women were expected to bring the tea and clear out the refrigerator, or everybody was expected to, you know, pray, even though there were some non-practicing Christian members of the workplace, I mean, or cross themselves, you know, there are small things that if they're imposed based on a protected characteristic are seriously discriminatory, no? Or is that not the district's position?
Your Honor, we think that that situation is different, and we think that it would likely be actionable because those would be changes to the conditions of employment. And even if you apply the Supreme Court severe and pervasive test from cases like Meritor, we think an environment in which a woman walks in every day and is forced to serve tea where her male employees are not, simply on the basis of her gender or anything that is equivalent, would rise to the level of pervasive hostility. And so we do think that that distinction matters. What we're advancing here is simply the same position that was adopted.
Why isn't location a change in location? Let's say men get offices with views and women get offices with no windows.
So I think you would ask two questions there, Your Honor. One is that a condition of employment? And I think that
is it or not? Is location a condition of employment?
I think if it's window, no window, I think that that would rise to the level of a condition.
But what's outside the window? It's a window. Okay, so now we've all got windows. Women get views of the building next door, so essentially a brick wall, and men get views of the river.
And then I think the question would be, Your Honor, is that de minimis or not?
I'm asking you, I'm not even asking you that. What I'm asking you is whether that location is a term, condition, or privilege of employment.
I think that it could well be. What I don't think
could
is-
well
I don't
be, think it, it, sorry. Okay,
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, you finish your sentence, sorry.
I think that it could well be. I think as to what constitutes a condition of employment, it's going to be a circumstantial inquiry. What I don't think is I don't think that that would count as a lateral transfer. And again, we think that that is the only issue that the court needs to address in this en banc case. It is not a lateral transfer to give me a window office with one view versus another. And as to lateral-
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Judge Lund, please.
Go ahead.
No, please.
If you have the accounting group has gotten really large, and I'm in the accounting group, and so it's divided into two spaces, one up on the top floor of the penthouse and one down in the basement, which was its original location. A decision is made that hours are going to be the same, duties are going to be exactly the same, supervisors will be the same, but we're going to put the male accountants up with the penthouse area and the women, you stay in the basement. And I apply to go to the penthouse because golly, who doesn't want to be there instead of in the basement? And they say, no, you cannot move there because you're a woman. You will stay in the basement accounting group. Is that a transfer, denied transfer?
That is not a denial of a transfer because the position itself hasn't changed, but-
Location has changed. Didn't we, Ortiz-Diaz, we talked about location as a form of transfer.
In Ortiz-Diaz, Your Honor, it was a transfer between two different offices. And so I think that being sent to a different city or a different state in the mine run of cases, unless
you're- A different building, a different part of DC wouldn't matter.
A different part of DC, if it's not a change in position, if your position has not been assigned to office building A versus office building B, which I think-
How do you define transfer then? Because my hypothetical certainly affects either a term or condition, your location of where you're doing your work. See, that seems to me at least arguably, but maybe I'm wrong. How are you defining transfer that it doesn't include such a change in the physical location of where you're working?
So Your Honor, and to be candid, we searched the case law for a very good and clear definition of lateral transfer and we're not able to find one.
I couldn't find one either. So that's why I'm looking for your help.
But looking to this court's cases and given that we think a transfer is going to be the change of in terms of the terms of employment, we think that it would be something relatively formal of
terms, conditions, or privileges. Any of those could be affected by a transfer, right? Or you think transfers are only about terms?
We think that they very neatly fit into the definition of terms. To be sure, they could be conditions as well, but because terms is arguably the most demanding language in the statute, if you meet that, we think that you are set. And we also think that there's not going to be such a thing as a de minimis term.
Can I ask a question about transfer?
What's the policy reason underlying your resistance to Chambers' articulation of the standard here. I'm curious to know what is driving you to want to create this space? Is it, as the court-appointed amicus says, that we just need to leave room for employers to manage the workplace? Is that what this is about?
I think that's right, Your Honor. So take the hypothetical that the amicus articulated in its brief, where perhaps on one afternoon, you're transferred from, you know, sporting goods to...
So that's the purest example, right?
Exactly. Now, as an employer, you're not necessarily going to be able to articulate 2, 5, 10 years later why you made that transfer, even though it has nothing, may have nothing to do with race or with gender. And so we think that the statute does need to be read in a way that's workable and in a way that allows employers to engage in the day-to-day business of managing.
I understand that, but isn't it perfectly workable to say that the employer can manage the workforce in any way the employer wants to, so long as the employer doesn't take account of race in its decisions? Why isn't that completely workable? We have a lot of, the courts have a huge amount of experience in teasing out the different cases where there is discrimination from cases where there isn't. McDonnell Douglas is a pretty good workhorse that has done that successfully. So what's, I really am trying to understand what it is that's so important to create this space for some discrimination for employers. What is that? What's that about? Can you explain it to me a little more?
Of course, Your Honor. And again, as a normative matter, we would reiterate that the ideal is to eliminate all discrimination in the workplace. Exactly. We just don't think that the statute does that. In terms of why we think that the de minimis threshold is required from a practical standpoint, I think there are two different points. One is the point that I just articulated, which is that in a scenario where difference in treatment enough is sufficient to shift the burden, and then the employer needs to articulate its non-discriminatory reason. If we're talking about de minimis activities, you know, who got the earlier lunch break on one day or the nicer customer, those aren't things that are going to be memorialized, and they're not necessarily things that the employer is going to be able to present, even if the motive was not discriminatory. And so to have no de minimis exemption puts the employer in a bit of a bind.
Won't it be just as difficult? I mean, in those kinds of situations, it's going to be just as difficult, if not more so, for the plaintiff to come up with some evidence of discrimination. The plaintiff can't just say, I was discriminated against by not getting the view of the fig tree. The employee has to come up with, you know, either direct evidence of that or enough evidence to create a prima facie case. So that's who has to first come up with the evidence. The employer doesn't have to prove anything until the employee gets over that hump. And so given that, I guess I still don't understand what it is you're trying to protect employers from, given the purpose of Title VII when it was first enacted, to rid the workplace of racial discrimination. I still don't get what it is you're trying to accomplish here by leaving some space for, quote, minimal or de minimis discrimination.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree as to how high a burden the employee has, at least at the motion to dismiss threshold. I mean, in many instances, it is enough to simply allege that I was treated differently than the male in the cubicle next to me, and then suddenly the doors to discovery.
Well, that's exactly why most employers are smart enough to file a motion for summary judgment. That's the way you get rid of these cases.
But after a tremendous amount of burdensome discovery and time, and
courts can limit discovery. Courts have very helpful tools for protecting employers from excessive discovery.
To be sure, Your Honor, but I think this case actually is a good example of the burdens that can be placed on an employer when a case moves past the motion to dismiss. I mean, some of the district's most high-level officials were deposed here.
I thought your position was this case was actionable. Isn't that your position?
That is, but we're talking about...
Then I really don't understand where you're going. I mean, you're telling me that there's... What you're trying to do is protect employers from undue burdens. But at the same time, you say this case is an example of the situation employers are put in, but then you tell us this case is actionable. I don't get it.
So I think that this case is an example of the burdens that occur in general at summary judgment. To be sure, we think that this case, in terms of the adverse action, is actionable because we think all lateral transfers are actionable. But you could just as easily imagine a similar case about something like the view of the fig tree. And in those instances, we do think that it makes sense to have some mechanism to...
So can I just make one clarification, which is, as I understand your conception of what you're categorizing as de minimis, it's some adversity threshold. It's different, I think, than the one that the Sixth Circuit was talking about in the threat case or three, which however you pronounce it, because as I understand it, there, the Sixth Circuit was talking about a cross-cutting principle of de minimis harm that isn't tethered to Title VII as such. It doesn't come from the text of Title VII. But your understanding of Title VII is that under the text of A1, discriminate against just doesn't occur unless there's been a level of harm. So am I right in understanding that they're coming from different places? You think it comes from Title VII itself. It's not a generally applicable de minimis harm principle, whereas the Sixth Circuit, I thought, viewed it differently.
So we think that the fact that that some level of injury is required does come from the statutory text discriminate against, again, because the Supreme Court has said so, interpreting the identical words in White and reiterated something along those lines in Bostock. As to what that level of harm should be, whether it's material adversity or de minimis harm, that we do think comes from the background principle of de minimis occurrences being exempted from statutes in the ordinary course.
So you see the de minimis background rule, and then unlike Mr. Wolfman, who says that is just swept away by the discrimination, anything that's for a prohibited discriminatory reason is not going to be de minimis. And you're saying, well, no, actually the statute makes room for that in its text. And that's where you're sort of belting and suspendering with statutory text and with the background de minimis rule. Is that right?
I think that is one way to look at it, Your Honor. The de minimis rule is an ancient principle, and it's something of a rebuttable presumption, right? When we assume that Congress intends for a de minimis rule to apply, unless it expressly says otherwise or the statutory context indicates otherwise. And here, when the statute speaks to larger issues in the employment environment, terms, conditions, privileges, we know that those words don't cover absolutely everything in the workplace because the Supreme Court has said so in cases.
Can I ask one follow-up question, which is on the what it means to be a transfer? Because what you're saying is lateral transfers per se are covered even if you interpose an injury requirement, because lateral transfers by definition satisfy the injury requirement. And there's been a lot of questions this morning that ask, well, what constitutes a transfer as opposed to something that affects the conditions, but that doesn't rise to the level of a transfer? And I guess the way I was thinking about it, and maybe this is wrong, and please correct me if this is wrong, I thought the employer defined what a position is. And then when somebody wants to move from one position to another, that's just based on the way the employer has defined a position. So, for example, to use the sporting goods and power tools example, if an employer classified a position as a power tools position and a sporting goods position, well, then moving from one to the other would be a transfer. But if employer just had salesperson and then had job tasks within it that could result in an assignment either to sporting goods or to power tools, well, that wouldn't be a transfer. It would be a switch of assignments within the position itself. It would functionally be the exact same thing, because what you'd be doing is you'd be working in one section of the store as opposed to another. It's just that in one situation, the employer would have chosen to define that as a position, but in another situation, they wouldn't have. Am I wrong about understanding the difference between transfers and switches and assignments that way, that it's bound up in how the employer defines a position, or is that your understanding?
We would agree with that, Your Honor, with two small caveats. One being that many contracts aren't necessarily written. There are informal employment agreements out there. And so that the inquiry may be a little more complicated in those scenarios. But in general, we think that looking to the contract, whether it be express or implied, is the right way to think about what constitutes a change.
I'm thinking about your point that Congress legislates with the background of the de minimis rule. Is the problem here that the only thing Congress said was, quote, discriminate against any individual with respect to, suppose Congress had said, discriminate against any individual in any respect at all with respect to his compensation. Would that have gotten rid of the de minimis rule?
I think that that would be sufficiently expressed, Your Honor, to...
So the problem is Congress didn't add the phrase to discriminate against individual in any respect at all, right?
Or something similar that would make clear that
do you know any action... You know, I'm really curious. Do you know of any case where we have... Do you know of any decision which has ever required Congress to be... I mean, it does say now, discriminate against any individual, and that's not enough. Do you know of any case that supports that position you're taking? I mean,
I don't know of a case that speaks in exactly those terms, but there are cases like Sandifer and others that do spell out when the presumption is rebutted. And they are cases where either the language is very explicit and expansive, or where the statute itself speaks to absolute minutiae like donning and doffing clothing. And I just don't think we have that here, particularly because Congress did specify terms, conditions, and privileges of employment rather than saying any workplace conduct.
Do you know whether there's anything in the legislative... I honestly don't know the answer to this. Is there anything in the legislative history that suggests that Congress wanted to leave a de minimis space? Do we know that?
Not using the words de minimis, not that I'm aware of. But there
any
are
word more... like that, you know, any word like that, whatever.
Not that comes to mind. The two things that do come to mind from the legislative history are, again, the repeated reference to employment opportunities, and then also the references to wanting to preserve, to the maximum extent possible, management and union prerogatives. So in our view, that has to leave space for something, and certainly leave space for a de minimis exception. But I would just reiterate what the Sixth Circuit said, which is that de minimis means de minimis. It's not going to be something...
Ms. Manzel, can I ask you a question? If there is an exception for de minimis, what is the gap between that and having a material harm? I mean, if something is not de minimis, isn't it by definition a material harm? I mean, what's the gap between materiality and de minimis? I'm just not sure I understand what that gap is.
Well, and to be fair, Your Honor, it is a tricky difference to encapsulate, particularly given that the Sixth Circuit recently said that at least in the context of the anti-discrimination provision, the two can be read to mean the same thing. I think the reason why we are slightly resistant to the materiality threshold is just that has been given a very specific meaning in the context of the anti-retaliation provision, which requires some concreteness. We think that that's right, but we think that because the anti-retaliation provision specifies neither the level of harm nor the type of harm, you know, it covers anything in the workplace or not. And the anti-discrimination provision differs. It at least specifies the type of harm, terms, conditions, privileges. We think that it's appropriate to use a lesser de minimis threshold because it has that tether.
Doesn't de minimis mean immaterial?
Yeah. I mean, it means trivial. It means trifles. And again, it's going to be context specific. So if this court wanted to use the word material and say material, de minimis, no difference, the same way that the Sixth Circuit did in the Threat case, we would not have a substantial objection to that.
Isn't then your objection just with how Brown has been applied in particular cases and not so much with the legal standard articulated in Brown?
I think that there are two things that we see major issues with in Brown. I think one is the importation of the Elrith test that is supposed to be used for vicarious liability, the imposition of that test for all substantive discrimination claims. I think that that is where the vast majority of the confusion or conflict in this court's cases has come from. And so we would certainly say that the court should go ahead and clarify that that is not the standard that applies. The other thing...
And I'm sorry, just on that point, you mean specifically the concept of a tangible injury as opposed to a material, something material as in non de minimis?
Yes, that's right. It's really the word tangible here that I think is the heart of the confusion in cases like Ortiz-Diaz and Douglas and the back and forth between the majority and the dissent there. Because in Meritor, the Supreme Court specifically said that harm does not have to be tangible to be actionable under Title VII. So I think if you strike the Elrith test from Brown, and then the second modification that we think is warranted in the context of this case is Brown creates a rule that says something more is needed other than the lateral transfer itself to make conduct actionable under Title VII. And we think that the reverse rule is actually more appropriate, that categorically a lateral transfer should be actionable because it goes to the very core of your employment relationship. And in that sense, it is sort of like the internal version of not hiring or firing. A position that is open to others is not open to you. And in those contexts, we don't ask, you know, if you weren't hired for a job, well, was the job that you occupy currently worse than the job that you were applying for? Simply being deprived of the position is enough to constitute the harm. So we do think that that is the best way to...
Can I ask just to try to figure... Am I stepping on someone else?
Oh, no, go ahead. I'll
on this de minimis. So if non-de minimis is the test that you want, is there a gap between having an injury that satisfies Article III standing? And so de minimis injuries, I take it, would satisfy Article III standing, but not state a claim under Title VII.
We do think that there is some difference there, again, because the de minimis would be pegged to terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. So, for example, under Article III, aesthetic harms are actionable. We don't think that most purely aesthetic harms are...
Well, it's a Title VII case, so what they're going to say is, I think this would satisfy Article III, tell me if I'm wrong, I was treated differently because of my race, sex, ethnicity, religion. And that's enough to get you past Article III.
I think that is correct. And then okay, we would say
that's not enough. And if they add with respect to a term, condition, or privilege of employment, that is not enough by itself to get you past into non-de minimis land.
Or is we think that's right. I mean, the injury we think...
Which is right. Sorry. I'm not being clear in my question. So I've said that I was treated differently based on my sex with respect to a term, condition, or privilege of employment, where I work, which office I'm in. So that would be enough for standing. Does that get you... Does that allegation, where I do my work, which office, does that get you past the non-de minimis, your non-de minimis threshold?
We don't think it necessarily would get you past the non-de minimis threshold. So we do think that non-de
minimis... The 12B6 dismissal of that complaint.
Right. So again, if we're...
What more are they supposed to say? I had a non-de minimis injury. I have been discriminated against based on a protected characteristic in a way that has injured me. So I have Article III injury. So I have been, it's a discrimination in Bostock's word that injured me. And it's with respect to a term, condition, or privilege of employment. And you say they have to say, what else do they have to mention?
Well, I mean, to satisfy Iqbal and Twombly, you would have to explain what the term condition or privilege is, right?
And I just said it's where I do my work, which location I do my work in, which office.
Right. And then the question is, have you plausibly claimed a non-de minimis?
Right. Why is that location of doing the work?
Well, so again, I think if the question is it a cubicle slightly to the right or slightly to the left, I think that that's a situation where that very well could be de minimis.
The cubicle versus office would be de minimis, would exceed the de minimis threshold? I mean, might say office, individual office.
I think the context may matter, but it well could. It well could. I think that most.
But it wouldn't categorically. It would not be enough to state a Title VII claim to say that because I'm a woman, I have to do my work in a cubicle. And if I were a man, and that's an intentional decision by the employer. We've said that requirement too. If I were a man, I could do it. I would have an office. Is that enough?
You know, I do think that would be enough to get you past 12B6. And then the context would more likely come in at the summary judgment standard. But I think that this is a perfect example of why moving incrementally.
Why would context matter? At that point, you might have to prove discrimination or not, like the basis. Was it on the basis of a protected characteristic? But why would you have to do anything more even at the summary judgment stage as to whether I have been discriminated against on the basis of a term, condition, or privilege of employment?
Well, I mean, conceivably, and again, I think that this is very unlikely to actually occur, but, you know, conceivably, you could be put in an office that has no door and is, you know, immaterially different from a cubicle. I grant you that would be a hard situation to imagine, but I think having a de minimis standard does kind of build in some room for those occurrences where the context kind of shifts whether we think that this is really a non-de minimis injury.
So your theory is, just to be crystal clear then, that Congress didn't mean it when it said no discrimination on the basis of terms, conditions, or privileges of employment based on a protected characteristic. What it meant was no big enough discrimination on a protected basis in your terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. That's just got to be what you mean. It just wasn't big enough difference.
Well, what we mean is that we think that Congress incorporated the usual de minimis threshold that applies to all statutes.
Right, so it just wasn't a big enough discrimination as to your term, condition, or privilege of employment.
Well, whether you want to...
If my retirement benefit is reduced by 1/20th of a penny a year, because I'm female, so that over the course, I will end up at the end of the day with retirement benefit that is 1 to 2 cents less than male employees. Is that de minimis?
It's conceivable that it would be de minimis. Again, I think you need to look at it in context. But what I would say is that this is why it is very crucial for the court to move incrementally and to adhere as closely
as
possible.
Make sure we protect the ability to have different retirement benefits based on
that. Ms. Van Zyl, has any court taken a more plaintiff-friendly view of Title VII than you are articulating here today?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that any court has. I think that this is the most plaintiff-friendly standard.
And even though hopefully we can all agree that any employer's intentional discrimination is worthy of our contempt, most legislation is the product of compromise, correct?
That's correct. And the Supreme Court has said
yes, Title VII itself is an exception to the rule that most legislation is the product of compromise.
I don't see Title VII as being an exception to that. And indeed, the Supreme Court in cases like Weber has said otherwise. And I think
So please finish.
And I would just point out that the Supreme Court's case law in the hostile work environment context is I think, an example of this, where the court has said that even though there are things that may occur in the workplace that we would all condemn in terms of conduct between supervisors and employees, those aren't necessarily actionable under the text of the statute. It's not because it's a policy reason we think that they should be occurring or that Congress thought they should be occurring. It's just, as you noted, Your Honor, that the terms of the statute are not unlimited, and it was a product of compromise.
What about stare decisis factors, which have gone unmentioned in most of the briefing and in today's discussion? What is the standard we're supposed to apply as an en banc D.C. Circuit with regard to whether to overturn a 30-year-old precedent?
Well, Your Honor, as to stare decisis, the district would have no strenuous objection if this court were to say for stare decisis reasons that they are going to preserve the status quo. I mean, we briefed this case under Brown versus Brody and shifted our position only when explicitly requested to de novo interpret the statutory text. That said, I believe in the most recent en banc precedent this court has issued, it's a high standard for overruling stare decisis in the statutory context, but if a case is fundamentally flawed, I mean, that could be a circumstance. Again, the district isn't taking a position one way or the other because, again, prior to a very explicit directive from this court, we used Brown versus Brody the same as any other litigant would have.
Right. I'm not blaming you for not, you weren't asked to brief what our standards should be, but I am just, my last question here is, do you think we sit more like a common law court deciding whether to overturn a common law precedent? Do you think we sit more like the Supreme Court deciding whether to overturn a statutory precedent? Do you think we sit, since we're en banc, as basically a court that is almost acting as if the precedent doesn't matter at all, so long as we think the precedent was fundamentally flawed? What kind of court do you think we are in terms of what our standard should be?
I think given the case law, it's somewhere in between. So this court has cited Supreme Court precedent on stare decisis, but then generally turns to qualify that there are some circumstances outside of the extraordinary circumstances that would qualify for the Supreme Court to disregard stare decisis that may be relevant, among other things, because the court sits in panels of three, because other circuits may disagree with the approach taken by the circuit. Obviously, you know, there's not a major disagreement here, and it's certainly not the case in these circumstances that the majority of courts have said that lateral transfers are per se actionable. In fact, I'm not aware of a court that has said that, has gone that far to institute a per se rule. So the answer is it's not quite like to the Supreme Court, a little bit of a lower burden, but still fairly rigorous.
Thanks.
Could I take you back to the specific adjustment of Brown that you've asked for, the second of your two? So suppose we were to clean it up just a little bit by saying that the tangibility element coming from Ellerth isn't exactly right. The materiality requirement shouldn't be understood as a really high burden. It's just the opposite of, it just means non de minimis. You ask for a categorical rule that transfers meet that requirement. So why would we do that? Why doesn't the cleanup I've described sort of permit the kinds of cases you want to permit? And a categorical statement as to transfers is going to put a lot of pressure on a second order analytical question that Judge Millett's been asking about, which is what is a transfer? that's not a term that appears in Title VII and not a question that has an obvious answer. So why would we sort of create that extra step? And then when we get the follow-on cases, we'll be, instead of just asking whether the harm was non-de minimis, we'll have to ask ourselves whether the shift from tools to sporting goods is a, quote, transfer, close quote. That seems unnecessary.
Well, Your Honor, we think a clean rule for transfers would make this court's job in the mine run of cases easier. I mean, again, the transfer situation that this court has actually confronted are situations like the one in Brown versus Brody, where you're transferred from a division to a division, the divisions do completely different work, or from one state to another, as in Ortiz-Diaz. But that said, if the court wanted to proceed even more incrementally, I don't think that the district, again, would have a strenuous objection to that. The idea was simply by proposing a bit of a categorical approach, which this court has used from time to time, would make the job simpler. You wouldn't have to necessarily ask in context that de minimis question for a certain category of claims.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, but if the court disagrees and wants to move more incrementally, again, no strenuous objection from the district.
Okay, thank you.
Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you, Ms. Van Zyl. Thank you, Ms. Van Zyl.
I have a question.
Oh, please, Judge Wilkins.
Can you just explain exactly how, under these facts, Chambers was a transfer? Because you said earlier, if I remember correctly, in response to questioning, that, well, the employer can kind of define what a transfer is by the job description or the job title. So in this case, we know that this is a transfer because what Chambers requested had a different job title. Is that how we know it was a transfer? I'm just trying to make sure I understand your theory here.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district has a formal organizational structure in the Child Support Services Division where there are different units that do different things. Generally, in terms of our units or sections, you are hired into one or the other. That's a term of your employment. And so this transfer would have involved a relatively formal and permanent move from one unit to another to do a different type of work.
I thought part of what was going on here was this at one point was a restructuring. And sometimes job titles change in restructurings, even if what you do, where you do it, who your supervisor is, and when you do it don't change. So I'm curious about your answer that it's because her job title could change, or is it organizational chart?
No, Your Honor, it's more in the nature of the organizational chart. As we said in our brief, we don't think a nominal change in title if the organization reorganizes is going to be sufficient. It's that formal change in position, and here accompanied by doing a different kind of work.
So job duties, change in what work you're doing, your job duties is pretty important to define and transfer.
If it is a day in, day out job duties to which you are formally assigned, yes. If it is, again, going back to the big box store hypothetical where you're working in sporting goods or not, we think that that is more in the nature of a condition than a term of employment.
Well, once every 3 years, female employees also have to clean up the coffee room. Men never do. So it's not permanent. It's not every day, but it happens, and it happens only to women. And there's a memo to the file, as Judge Tatel would say, that says it's because they're women. You think women should clean.
Your Honor, that would be analyzed not as a per se rule, but as a condition of employment. We don't think that that is a change in the position. It's a change in the job duties, but that may well be sufficiently pervasive or severe. I think, again, using the hostile work environment test that it
wouldn't fall in your de minimis exception either.
Well, severe, if it's severe or pervasive, it's going to be more than de minimis. So
my hypothetical wasn't severe or pervasive.
If it's,
well, we can debate whether it's severe, but it's really more pervasive.
Well, we know if it's in the hostile work environment context, it has to at least be severe or pervasive. And so
there's one thing, and it's every 3 years you have to clean up the coffee room. That's a judicial job duty.
Again, Your Honor, that if in the scope of your duties, that is de minimis. And it may well be a jury question as to whether that is, but if it's
de minimis, is a jury question?
Not always, but I mean, like any of these standards, like severe or pervasive, I mean, they're going to be close cases. And if cases sufficiently close that reasonable people, reasonable juries could disagree, then it would.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Van Zyl. We'll hear from the court appointed amicus now, Mr. Schaff.
Thank you, and may it please the court. The court should adhere to Brown's settled rule that plaintiffs suing over lateral transfers must show material objective harm, and the court should reject requests to adopt a position that no court anywhere has embraced. Now, we think stare decisis militates strongly against this result. The answer to Judge Walker's question is that the general standard this court applies is whether an existing precedent is fundamentally flawed, but I think the critical mass case shows that in the context of a case like this, where you have the uniform view of the circuit and decades of statutory precedent, it's just not fundamentally flawed. But I sort of want to go straight to the merits, because I think we've got a pretty fundamental difference with Mr. Wolfman about what this case is about. I mean, his view is this is all about the phrase terms, conditions, or privileges. But, you know, my view is that, you know, instead, it's really about the phrase otherwise discriminate against, and the Supreme Court's interpretations of that phrase in Harris and Meritor, and its interpretation of the phrase discriminate against in, you know, those cases adopt a threshold level of harm that is almost exactly like Brown's. And, you know, I have not heard from the other side, either in their briefs or today, any textual way to square their position with the Supreme Court's interpretation of those cases. So, you know, I think when we've got this type of settled statutory precedent, you know, that really should be it. And the other thing I'll say about White is it's not just that White interpreted a materially adverse standard that is very similar to Brown's, but it actually talks about reassignment specifically. And this, I think, goes to the district's position that you should have some categorical rule for lateral transfers. I mean, what White says is reassignments are not automatically actionable under a materially adverse standard. Instead,
can I interrupt you just a second? If a person is denied a transfer because of his race, he's African American, and that transfer would have gone to a white person, isn't that person discriminated against?
So, I mean, we don't think so within the meaning of the statute.
But to stick with the language, this is the language in the statute. Tell me why that's not discrimination against him.
Well, I think there's three textual arguments. So the first textual argument, you've heard two of them. The first is that the phrase discriminate against means to treat worse in a matter that injures. Like the Supreme Court said.
I didn't hear what you said. It's in a manner that what?
In a manner that injures. So
that's not in the statute.
No, but I think the court should start, you know.
I was asking you about the statutory phrase. The only phrase we have is discriminate against. It doesn't say discriminate against in a way that endangers. It says discriminate against. So, I mean, maybe there's a good answer to this, but I didn't see it in your brief. Why isn't that person in my hypothetical discriminated against because a white person would have gotten that job?
Right. So, I mean, within the meaning of the statute, the answer is, you know, one, the way the Supreme Court has interpreted those words, two, the de minimis backdrop.
Has the Supreme Court said that the denial of a lateral transfer based on race is not discrimination against?
The Supreme Court hasn't talked about lateral transfers under the discrimination provision, but actually, I mean, it has said, but in White, though, it said that a reassignment of job duties standing alone does not constitute discriminating against someone under the anti-retaliation provision, which I think gets awfully close.
We know from White that anti-retaliation is different from discrimination. Right.
It's different, but totally not in a way that helps.
Statutory structure.
Well, it's different, but I think not in a way that helps the other side here, because the difference is this limiting phrase, terms, conditions, or privileges of employment, is absent. And so there, I don't think there's any alternative to the other side's view but to say those same words mean something different in 703A1 than they mean in 704. And I think that is a grave textual problem for them that I think, frankly, just makes it impossible for them to meet the fundamentally flawed standard that this court's case is set. The third argument I just want to get on the table in terms of the text is the jus in generis canon. This phrase we're interpreting here, otherwise discriminate against, is a residual. And what that canon teaches is that we presume that it incorporates things of the same basic type as the things that were enumerated. So to fail or refuse to hire or to discharge. And, you know, those things we think are material and objective harms. And so the natural way to interpret this residual is covering things of the same basic type. And, you know, again, the court isn't operating on a blank slate here. You know, this is the interpretation that the Supreme Court arrived at in the Harris case. Harris says expressly there's going to be some harassment under Section 703A1 that affects terms and conditions of employment, but not to a sufficient degree so as to implicate Title VII. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about whether the right standard is material or de minimis and what those mean. But my fundamental submission to the court is once you're in the universe of sort of arguing about which of those standards is the right one, you have gone far outside anything that could justify getting rid of two decades of statutory precedent where, again, all the circuits agree.
If discriminate against means treat deferentially and it includes, I'm going to go with you on your interpretation that it includes some kind of injury component just for purposes of this question. So how is it not discriminating against when you've been denied a transfer that someone else would have gotten if they were a different gender, a different sex, or different race?
Well, so I think what, you know, White and Bostock say is that you look for injury. And if that other position would have been objectively identical, you know, you haven't, I think, been injured. But I also don't want to push too hard on that point, because I think, you know, you need, you know, the other parts of our statutory arguments, the de minimis backdrop principle and the jus in generis canon, you know, paired with what the Supreme Court has said about these terms to sort of get all the way to the standard that this court applied to Brown.
Can I take you into the weeds of Brown for a minute and just figure out what parts of it you're trying to preserve and maybe what parts of it you're not? So you could conceivably tease out of Brown three different possible elements: materiality, objectivity, and tangibility. And you sort of quietly toss tangibility over. Seems to me like it's the weakest of the three. What difference, if any, do you understand between materiality and objectivity? Do you think both are important, and are they doing independent work?
Yes, I think both material and objective are important and they do independent work. You know, material, I think, is understood as a sort of significance threshold, and, you know, objective differentiates between, you know, objective and subjective. On the tangibility point, I don't want to be quiet about it because I want the court to be sort of clear on what I think. The way I would read tangibility is just, you know, whatever meaning it has is sort of consumed by objective and material when you put those two things together. And the reason I say that is sort of twofold. One is that, you know, the Supreme Court has said, actually before Brown, that there's no tangibility requirement if what you mean is sort of pocketbook harms. And, you know, this court after Brown in cases like Friedman and Ginger and Holcomb, you know, these are things about sort of work rules and work responsibilities, has, you know, found those cases to satisfy Brown, you know, even though there wasn't a pecuniary pocketbook harm. So I think that's just accurately capturing the place where, you know, this court's precedent is and really has to be.
I understand. So if materiality, your basic argument is that means non de minimis, I get that. What is objectivity get beyond materiality in that sense? And where does it come from?
Well, so I think, you know, objective comes, what objective means is that it relates to, you know, objective facts in the world and not just someone's preferences. You know, the fact that Chambers here, for example, had a preference to be in the intake unit and not the interstate unit isn't enough. And, you know, in terms of where it comes from, I think the first answer is, you know, it comes from Harris and Meritor and White, all of which require, you know, a sort of showing of objective harm interpreting identical text. And, you know, in terms of, you know, where that in turn comes from, I think it is, again, a combination of the de minimis background principle plus the structural inference that comes from the adjustum generis canon.
Thank you.
Where does the statute make the employee's motivation relevant rather than, not the whole statute, 703A1, where does it make that relevant rather than the employer's motivation? And to give you a concrete example, you talked about the, I'm in sporting goods, but I'd rather be in power tools. And that's my preference, whatever reason. And the employer says, women can't do power tools. That's a high testosterone area. Men won't buy power tools from women. They won't trust women as knowing anything about power tools. So while y'all rotate around on the floor as part of your job description, you, because you're a woman, you're not going to power tools. Why does whether that's prohibited by the plain text of 703A1 turn on whether she wanted to go there because of career advancement or because she really likes power tools?
Well, so I think, you know, the short answer is the Supreme Court's cases have both and all interpreted this identical text to require an objective showing. You know, so for example, in Harris, it is not sufficient to show that, you know, a woman subjectively feels that conduct is harassing. It's got to be objective. And, you know, similarly, in White.
But we're talking now about a term, condition, or privilege of employment. That is what my job is, right? What work I'm doing today or this week or this month, which was, I think, is different in the hostile working environment cases because the assumption there is that until you have a sufficient accumulation of actions, it doesn't yet affect your terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. All right. So that's why that was different. But now we're talking about, we have express evidence, the decision as to what your job duties are this month is based on your gender, a gender stereotype. And you're saying that still, we still don't know that 703A1 prohibits that until we ask about why she wanted the position.
Right. So, I mean, I do have to quibble, I think, with the reading of Harris, because I think what Harris says is that you are going to have something that could be a change in conditions of employment, but unless it, quote, sufficiently affects the employee so as to implicate Title VII's purposes, then, you know, it's not actionable. You know,
eliminating gender stereotypes and depriving me of a work opportunity because my sex is not what 703A1 is aimed at.
No, so let me be very clear. Depriving you of work opportunities is absolutely what 703A1 is about. And I think this is an important point on some of the hypotheticals you hear about what if, you know, you've got the denial of a transfer that's expressly based on race because, you know, there's this memo in the file. And I think most of those hypotheticals are going to be taken care of by this court's decision in Ortiz-Diaz, which says that if you want a transfer and you need that transfer, you say, and you can show this by evidence, to get away from a supervisor who is going to stifle your career because they are racist and sexist, then that is actionable.
No, but in my hypothetical, we can change it to race if you want to change it to race. And if it is Black people can't do power tools. We don't think for whatever biased reason, we don't think they're capable of selling power tools. And the reason the employee, instead of, you know, for the same reason I said, based on sex, I'll change it to based on race if you want, is I actually really love power tools. I love working with power tools. And you're saying that is not prohibited by 703A1. Black people can't sell power tools in my store because I don't think Black people are capable of that activity.
So I think, you know, the answer is, if that's all you've got, and, you know, you've got the existence of, say, segregation, then, you know, that is not enough without more. But usually you will have the more, because
yeah, but if you don't, I don't have more. What I have in this case is exactly what I've told you, whether you want to do it based on sex or based on race. And that is a desire by an employee. Pay's going to stay the same. Hours are going to stay the same. But what I'm going to be selling, whether it's of interest to me, something I really am passionate about. And just to be crystal clear, your reading of 703A1 is that we can have the most malevolent, intentional, readily documented, stereotypical discrimination by the employer. And Title 703A1 says, not good enough. I need to know why the employee wanted that job. You have to have both sides.
You have to show objective material impact on your work environment or your opportunity to advance or things like that. But
and
let
what
me give,
job
give
you're
another
doing
reason.
In that work environment?
Well, it could be. So, you know, for example, in the Holcomb case.
My hypothetical. I just want to stick with my hypothetical. That one would not be. You're saying that is not actionable under Title VII.
So, you know, if, you know, the supervisory level and, you know, burdens of work and all of that are all the same, then like that without more is not actionable. But let me try to answer this way. I don't think you should be surprised by that, because in Section 703A2, you know, Congress talked about segregation, which is one of the core, you know, evils that Title VII was enacted to prevent. And there, if you want to plead a cause of action, you have to show that you were adversely affected by the segregation. You know, it's not just enough to show sort of the segregation in the ether. And another place to see this is, you know, this isn't a Title VII case, but the Virginia Military Institute case in the Supreme Court. It's about the Equal Protection Clause. You had this separate institution for women that Virginia created. And, you know, Justice Ginsburg there didn't say the creation of this separate institution per se violates the Equal Protection Clause. She went through and showed, as a matter of fact, that separate institution didn't provide equal educational opportunities, didn't provide the same quality of education. And, you know, our fundamental submission here is that, you know, it is the same under Section 703A1.
So can I say on the A2 comparison, the position that the United States takes today is that for disparate treatment purposes, A2 doesn't cover anything that A1 doesn't already cover. Right. If that's true, then the fact that for a segregation hypothetical, you need an adverse effect under A2 wouldn't matter, because you could still get to it under A1, right?
So that's what I think shows is sort of so odd about the other side's interpretation. You know, they read everything to be actionable under Section 703A1, even segregation that we know Congress focused on in 703A2 and still required an adverse effect.
Segregation is not actionable under A1?
So, I mean, it is if you can show a sufficient level of harm. Just like, you know, in the Virginia Military Institute case, like it will, and in practice, it typically is going to be actionable on a couple different theories. One is the Ortiz-Diaz theory we've talked about, that, you know, this person who's segregating you is also going to squelch your career advancement. A second theory that's going to be available is that you're just preventing people from sorting into where they're, you know, where they fit best. So the woman who's like much better at selling power tools can't do that. And a third is that we know as a factual matter that when you have segregated workplaces and, you know, whether that's by race or gender, you know, the workplace that becomes feminized, typically the pay is going to be less and the opportunities for advancement are going to be less. And, you know, the basic point is you just need to show that as a factual matter, and it's not presumed.
We presume separate is still equal under Title VII.
So, I mean, that's, to be totally frank, why I, gave the example of the Virginia Military Institute case. I mean, that would have been a much shorter way. But Mr. Schaff,
the Virginia Military Institute case is a very, very different case in the sense that there is, the backdrop was some single-sex education might be defensible if it really were materially equal. And it implicates the nature of developing an entire institution as opposed to the treatment of one person. So if you have a presumption that single-sex educational institutions might be permissible, you're not going to, you know, rule out separation. Whereas in the employment, I don't think anybody's ever argued that a single-sex employment, place of employment, or a place of employment that was racially discriminatory under Title VII would be permissible as somehow fulfilling some employment value. So it's just a really different, a very different context. I just don't see supporting some threshold level of harm under Title VII.
Well, I think you can find examples that actually fit that pretty well. So one of the examples given in, I think, the United States brief is requirements that men and women have different uniforms. And, you know, Congress under Section 703A2 clearly didn't think that was supposed to be actionable unless you could show an adverse effect on your employment opportunities. But nonetheless, the position that Chambers advocates here would make that actionable under Section 703A1. And, you know, our submission is that is quite a strange result. But, you know, something we haven't talked about, at least in my time, is, you know, what's on the other side of the balance. And, you know, we agree with the district that there are significant interests, not in approving discriminatory conduct and saying, you know, any amount of discrimination is okay. But when we're talking about the scope of Title VII's cause of action, then there are good reasons to do what the Supreme Court has said and separate significant from trivial harms, you know, avoiding a flood of cases where there's no genuine harm to remedy, avoiding the need to sort of determine someone's subjective preferences. I mean, we heard from Mr. Wolfman that if Chambers prevails on remand, her damages are going to have to be based on, you know, her sort of subjective feelings about how she was treated. And then, you know, you've got the considerations that Ms. Van Zyl laid out present in the legislative history about not want, on the one hand, you know, Congress being very concerned with eliminating harmful discrimination, but on the other hand, not wanting to overburden employers and unduly interfere where there is no genuine harm to remedy. And, you know,
And denying someone the opportunity to do work that they're really, really interested in and really enjoy is a trivial harm.
Well, so I think this is where the Supreme Court has been and saying that you should strike a sort of middle path here. I mean, under Harris, you can have someone expressly harass someone and say, you know, I am harassing you because of your sex, but unless you can show that's severe or pervasive, it's not actionable. You know, under Section 70A4, you can have someone say, you know, I am expressly going to, you know, to use one of the district hypotheticals, take all of your staplers.
So the answer to my question is, under your definition of what counts as trivial or de minimis, that includes depriving people of the opportunity to do the work that they're most passionate about or most interested in doing. I'm just asking that question. Yes?
So I think if they cannot show an objective material difference between the position
they want to do. All I'm telling you is I can show that what I most want to do and I don't get to do it because of express, overt, racial or gender stereotyping.
Right. So I don't want to repeat myself, but the answer is yes, but you will often be able to make, you know, the Ortiz-Diaz type showing or, you know, the hostile environment type showing, but yes. So maybe let me talk a minute about the district sort of middle ground position and what I think is wrong with it. I mean, on the one hand, you know, it's narrower than the position you've heard from the other side. And so you might think is sort of preferable in that regard. But on the other, I think you can see it as sort of, you know, the worst of all possible worlds where you are overthrowing decades of precedent in favor of this categorical rule that sort of comes from nowhere and is going to lead to a new cottage industry of litigation over, you know, what constitutes a transfer or not. You know, is the 1 hour reassignment to sporting goods a transfer and how do we tell? And also, you know, that it is inconsistent, that bright line rule they seek to draw, with White in at least two different ways. First, what White says.
If a supervisor were to bring in, donuts on a Friday, on Fridays, put them out on the table and hang a sign over them that says for white employees only. Is that injury under your definition, or that's trivial?
I think that is, you know, does not meet this court's threshold. It's set in Brown, but I just have to keep, you know,
I get that it wouldn't meet Brown. I'm asking you whether it meets 703A1, your requirement of a non-trivial injury.
Right. So I don't think it would satisfy like the Supreme Court's test in White, which we think is very similar.
Is it a trivial injury?
So the donuts, let me be very clear. The donuts alone is a trivial.
The donuts with a sign that says for whites only, I'm not going to let you separate the two of them. Is that a trivial injury or not?
So I think if you can show that the for whites only sign is, you know, part of a employment atmosphere that is preventing you from advancing.
It's not part of anything else.
Right.
I'm not trying to put together a hostile work environment claim here. I'm trying to put asking a question. It might be sometimes rules have hard answers. So I'm just asking to try to get to what we mean by de minimis, trivial, intentional discrimination.
Right. So I think just the statement that you are depriving someone of donuts because of race is not enough. I think that is a necessary consequence of Brown's rule, as it's a necessary consequence of Harris and Meritor and White. But, you know, I do think the Ortiz-Diaz theory, which
the employer has two water fountains, they both function equally. Water's the same temperature, the same purification. And they put a sign up that says one for whites only, one for non-whites. And there's nothing else that happens there that suggests a racially hostile working environment. But Title VII says that's okay. 703A1.
Right, so Your Honor, we know very explicitly what Congress thought about that, because that is segregation, and it's covered under 703A2, mm-hmm. which requires a showing of an adverse effect.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the sign like that is not an adverse effect in its own right. Just to be clear.
Well, I think if the sign alone were an adverse effect, if the act mm-hmm. of segregation alone were an adverse effect, then you would not have any work for that other language in Section 703A2 to do. But like, to be very clear, people generally are going to be able to make the type of showing from Ortiz-Diaz or the hostile work environment claim from Harris as a factual matter. And you know, our fundamental mm-hmm. submission is that what Brown really does is it just makes you make that showing on the facts. And, you know, the reason it does it is, you know, so for example, in this case, if you sort of tweak the facts a little bit, where, you know, the district has two groups of people who do interstate cases, they've got group A and group B, and you want a transfer from A to B, even though they're objectively identical, you know, that's not actionable, not because we don't think that doing that for discriminatory reasons would be okay, but because of the reality that lawsuits impose significant costs. And, you know, that is why, again, White said it's important to separate significant from trivial harm.
So I think mixing up these workplace cases and discrete acts presents a problem. And everyone seems to resist Judge Tatel's effort, including the vigorous argument by the district government, that the Supreme Court had understood harm from discrimination to be harm in and of itself, separate but equal. Harm. And you can fight as to the evidence that was presented, but Dr. Clark's testimony was before the Supreme Court. And it ruled. And then 1964, Congress passes the statute. So one of the things about your argument that troubles me, maybe not as much as the district governments, is, you know, the precedent we have is all based on the courts trying to narrow, in my view, what Congress had in mind in 64. we don't want discrimination in the workplace. So when Judge Millett's question about two water fountains, I don't know how you say that isn't discrimination. That has a harm. It may be a psychological harm. It may be a developmental harm, but it's a harm. And maybe everybody here is too young to remember those days, but and maybe they don't teach it because it's too recent in history. But being discriminated against is a harm in and of itself. And that's, I thought, what Congress was trying to get at. And we don't need discrimination in the workplace. And that's not what our country stands for. And both the United States and the District of Columbia and all their job applications say, you know, we do not discriminate. So just like being a little bit pregnant is a term that used to be thrown around sewing, so being a little discriminated against, it just doesn't fit with the context, it seems to me, in which Congress was acting. And Judge Tatel gave everybody tons of time to point to legislative history or anything. We've had this de minimis rule. Congress says enough. We don't want discrimination in the workplace. So look at the discrete act. And that's what we're focused with here. And Brown was one of those cases that tried to make it more and more difficult. Ortiz Diaz, as you know, did not originally come out the way it ultimately came out. So let's be clear, Brown v. Brody has had an impact on what's happening in these cases. And the district obviously has thrown all that aside, saying it's too burdensome for us to defend these cases. Well, that's true what they said about sexual harassment too. So I guess I'm interested in that notion that if you look at the language in the statute, if you look at the legislative history, if you look at the historical context, why isn't the fact that Judge Millett has been posing in hypothetical after hypothetical enough?
So
you
may
lose when you get to the trier of fact, but at least you get the opportunity to get to the trier of fact. And it may be a burden on the district government defending these cases. But there are certain values that this country has and the Supreme Court has embraced.
So I think, you know, the short answer is that when there's obviously a lot in there, but when the Supreme Court has interpreted, you know, these provisions and said, we feel it's important in doing this to chart a middle path because there are important interests in both sides, then, you know, the appropriate thing for this court to do and the appropriate thing that Brown does is to chart that same middle path.
So on a discrete act of differential treatment on the basis of one of these protected factors is your strongest Supreme Court case?
Well, so I think a couple answers. I think the best Supreme Name Court one. Case on, sure, I think White is about reassignment
White
of job
duties. White is not a discrete act case. All right. And we all know that. And that's why I'm trying to get you to focus on what we're dealing with here.
Well, so I respectfully have to disagree on White, and then I'll go to some more examples and
you
points.
You think it was a discrete act case?
White talks about reassignments of job duties.
Yes.
I think that is a discrete act in the way you'd ordinarily understand it. You know, you have always been, on the shovel crew, and you are reassigned to the forklift crew, you know, that is a discrete act of reassignment, at least in some sense. And so I don't see any basis for distinguishing that case from this one on the text. And I would also go back to Harris. I mean, I hear you saying, and I think it's right, that there was not a sort of discrete act at issue in that case, but that case also reflects an interpretation of Title VII that says, you know, harassment, even if it affects terms or conditions of employment in some sense, is actionable only if it sufficiently does so, and this is a quote, so as to affect Title VII's purposes. And, you know, that I think really goes to some of the questions and comments that you've made, Your Honor, where, you know, it about the backdrop of Title VII and its history and purposes, you know, almost everything you said would have been true in Harris and as well. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court carved out some harassing conduct as outside of Title VII. And, you know, Justice Ginsburg, who did not, you know, slight the purposes of Title VII, both joined that opinion and wrote her own concurrence to emphasize that, in her view, the dominant consideration should be whether harassment, quote, unreasonably interfered with an employee's ability to do their job. That is the kind of pragmatic balancing that, you know, we think Brown reflects, like those Supreme Court cases.
Except for Brown in the Supreme Court.
Well, you are not going to hear any argument from me that segregation is abhorrent and it is harmful. But, you know, on Brown, one of the things that the Brown decision did is it went through and showed that that separate was not equal, just like the VMI case, just like Section 703A2 in segregation cases instructs courts to ask whether there's an adverse effect. And I totally hear the policy arguments about why you might not want that to be a rule. But it, our basic submission is if that's the view, then really the venue is Congress, particularly in a context like this one, where you have uniform precedent of the circuits that's been around decades reaching this result. I mean, you know, we cite in our brief the Gulf Oil case and the Manisin Rail case, where the Supreme Court itself accorded significant weight to this kind of unbroken circuit precedent. And, you know, we think the same is appropriate here.
Thank you, Mr. Schaff. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you.
Are you aware of a 702 case that said, because it doesn't say segregate or classify on the basis of race. It says segregate or classify in a way that would have an adverse, deprive or tend to deprive any individual employment opportunities or otherwise have an adverse effect on status as an employee. Are you aware of any case that has said if the segregation or classification were on the basis of race, sex, ethnicity, religion, that would not itself constitute an adverse effect? The adverse effect requires something more than that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's not many cases litigated under 702 on this sort of theory, but there is one from the Seventh Circuit, and I'm going to apologize. I don't have the citation handy. But if you do a search for the Seventh Circuit and Section 703A2, you will come up with a very recent case that holds exactly that.
It holds that segregating and classifying.
Right, that you need to show an adverse effect in a segregation case as well.
The segregation there was on the basis of a prohibited characteristic as opposed to some other characteristic.
That's right. So the basic claim was a Hispanic person said that their boss was sending all of Hispanic employees to a store in a Hispanic neighborhood, and that mm-hmm. that itself was actionable. And what the Seventh Circuit held is, you know, basically the Brown rule, that if you can show an adverse effect on employment opportunities or your ability to do your job, then it can proceed. But if not, not.
Thank you, Mr. Schaff. I don't think we have any further questions for you. Thank you, Mr. Wolfman. We'll give you some rebuttal time. You'll have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just start where the court appointed counsel left off. I'm not familiar with that Seventh Circuit case, but if that's the rule in that case is wrong. You cannot do that to people on the basis of national origin or race. That is a violation of 703A1. I want to go to one point that has been raised a number of times, which the original question from Judge Tatel was, is there legislative history that mentions the de minimis rule? There is not. But what there is, and I don't think you need this to resolve this case because the text resolves it, but we review legislative history at page 26 of our opening brief, and it says quite the opposite, that the purpose of the law was to eradicate all discrimination. And the Supreme Court has said the same thing. For instance, in Manhart, it says the purpose of the statute was to target the entire spectrum of disparate treatment. In Franks versus Bowman, the court said, Congress prohibited all practices in whatever form which create inequality in employment opportunity due to discrimination. So I think to the extent that you're looking beyond the text, and I don't think it's necessary, I think it's supportive of us. I do want to note a couple other points. On Burlington Northern versus White, I do not think it is fair to say that the court interpreted the words discriminated against different from how we are suggesting it be interpreted. The court says on page 59 of the opinion, no one doubts that the term discriminated against refers to distinctions or differences in treatment that injure protected individuals. It then goes on to give its interpretation.
Sorry, what page are you on? Because I have one. Oh, I thought you said 59. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's 59. And, then the court then goes on for purposes beyond the text to serve the purposes of the statute, which are to encourage employee reporting of discrimination, oppositional conduct, to go on to hold what it does in that case on the basis of the policy considerations. Here, all you have to do is focus on the text of the statute, which is not oriented towards the employee, but as I've said, only to employee conduct. And that's all that's necessary to resolve this case. Again, in White, the concern was encouraging employee conduct. The final thing I would want to say, because I know my time is limited, I want to end where court-appointed amicus began, with stare decisis. Stare decisis exists to protect reliance interests. Except for court-appointed amicus, no one here relies on Brown. No one claims a legitimate interest in making discriminatory job transfers. The federal government seeks to overrule it and largely agrees with our position. Not a single amicus typically present to defend here employers' interests is here to defend the rule in Brown. And beyond that, so there are no reliance interests before the court. Beyond that, the rule has been applied inconsistently. As Judge Rogers suggested in her concurrence in Ortiz-Diaz, the denial of transfer was considered objectively harmful in Ortiz-Diaz because of the transfer's, quote, potential to aid Ortiz-Diaz's professional development, end quote. But Samuel Forquio's forced reassignment, which resulted in him being closed out of meetings with high-level management, among other things, wasn't considered objectively harmful, even though it's common that access to high-level management is critical to advancing one's career. My point being, and here's where I want to end, Brown is not a rule that employers and employees can rely on because it is really no rule at all. In our view, the decision, Brown should be overruled, the district court's decision should be reversed, and the case remanded for consideration of Ms. Chambers' claims. Thank you.
Mr. Wolfman, you began your rebuttal with reference to the legislative history, I think, on this question of de minimis carve-out. So here's what I'm concerned with. This is from a case called Wisconsin Department of Revenue versus William Wrigley Jr. Company. Wisconsin asserts that the plain language of the statute bars this recognition of a de minimis exception because the immunity is limited to situations where the, quote, the only business activities within the state, close quote, are those described in the statute. This ignores the fact that the venerable maxim, de minimis non curat lex, is part of the established background of legal principles against which all enactments are adopted and which all enactments, absent contrary indication, are deemed to accept. The court then cites five of its own precedents. So my question is this, what is the contrary indication in the statute that there's no carve out for de minimis here?
I will, with respect, Judge Ginsburg, I will answer that the way I answered it earlier, which is to the extent that there is one, we don't need to fight with that, the venerable principle. To the extent that there is one, discrimination alone gets you beyond any de minimis threshold. That's what the statute prohibits. It's an enormously important value in our society. The Congress made that clear in 1964, and the anti-discrimination principle is as old as the Civil War Act amendments to the Constitution. So if there is a de minimis exception, it has been overridden anytime someone proves discrimination.
So discrimination alone is by itself not de minimis.
That is correct.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Sorry, just for these discrimination with respect to terms, conditions, or privileges of employment is really.
That is correct. And here, I think we've already made our point as to what our definition is of those things. But I think that's an important limitation, Judge Millett, that this statute doesn't affect things outside the workplace, and it's only with respect to five prohibited characteristics.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments this morning. Mr. Schaff, you were appointed by the court to assist the court in this matter, and the court thanks you for your assistance. We'll take this case under submission.